Hi, welcome to this week's program.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree.
Around this time of year, I'd like to cover PNC Bank's tongue-in-cheek Christmas Price Index, where they track the prices of a basket of goods mentioned in the holiday classic, The 12 Days of Christmas. You know, the one that goes, on the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me, and so on and so on. And by the 12th day, the list includes 12 drummers drumming, 11 pipers piping, 10 lords leaping, and so on. Remember? So, PNC compiles prices of what all these gifts cost true loves every year. In 2018, PNC Wealth Management found that the cost of all these gifts, what they call the total Christmas price index, was $39,094, up $446 or 1.1% from last year, up $9,800 since 2008, which is a whopping 33%. That officially puts the index at about a 3% compound annual rate over the last 10 years. So how did this quirky inflation idea get started? Well, it was started by the chief economist at a PNC predecessor bank in Philadelphia in 1984 and has averaged an annual year-over-year increase of 1.9%. Now, 1.9% is less than the real consumer price index, or CPI as it's known, which has increased at an annual rate of 2.67%. PNC's Christmas index also broadly mirrors economic conditions. A lot of last year's items stayed the same price. The cost of French hens, calling birds, swans, and the employed, like maids a-milking and ladies dancing, aren't making any more money this year due to the well-known fact that wages have been stagnating. Some progress has been made for leaping lords. They received a 3% increase. And musicians will be happy to note that pipers and drummers have seen a consistent yearly increase in their wages, both experiencing wage increases of 3.5%, and this comes after an increase last year of 2.8%. So, what category has had the highest jump in price last year? Well, there's not a lot of increases to note, with the exception of geese a-laying. They're the largest jump in price, up $390, putting them at an 8.3% increase. And the biggest loser? 5 gold rings. Up 10% last year, this year they're back down 9.1% at only $750 for all 5. And drumroll please, the most expensive item on the list were the 7 swans a-swimming, costing a whopping $13,125, and they remained at that price for the past 3 years. Now, if you were actually to send these as presents over the 12 days, repeating the gifts every day like the song, that would leave you with 364 gifts and a grand total of $170,609.46. Now, the Christmas Index comes with its own website, which is PNCChristmasPriceIndex.com, and has been developed as an interactive experience so educators can explain economic trends to middle and high school students. So that's pretty cool. And if you're really curious about how the prices of maids a-milking or lords a-leaping have changed over the years, head over to the website for more details. Now, getting serious a little bit here, I want to talk about 5 golden rules of holiday shopping. Always remember these 5 golden rules to keep a lid on the cost of your holiday shopping. So here goes. Number 1, be choosy. Pare down your list to those you're really close to and don't get guilt trapped into buying gifts for faraway relatives or long-forgotten friends that you're really not in touch with anymore. Instead, send them an e-card or a long email with photo attachments, updating them on what you've been up to and how your family has grown. Number 2, create a budget. Once you've narrowed down your list, decide on how much you will spend per person. Keep it reasonable and stick to your budget. Number 3, find bargains. There are a lot of smart deals online with coupons, free shipping, no-hassle returns, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and so on. So take advantage of those promotions. And number 4, get crafty. You could also save a ton if you plan and make gifts ahead of time, such as knitted scarves, a batch of homemade Christmas cookies, or one of a million gift ideas available over the internet. A personal touch is always warmly received, provided you've put a little thought and effort into the making of the gift. You could also get creative and swap gifts for donations to the gift receiver's charity or schedule a date, such as a show or a movie, so you get your family time with your loved ones. Donations also reinforce charitable giving with kids and give them a chance to appreciate the things they have in life. And lastly, number 5, pay smartly. This is a great time to cash in your credit card rewards for gift cards or gifts. Consider using prepaid cards so you can stick to your budget. And if you use credit cards, make sure you have a plan to pay them off right away because the interest can quickly add up. And if you pay your balance every month, get the card that has the most generous points, miles, or cashback features that fit your lifestyle. If you're shopping online, make sure you're shopping at secure websites where the payment page has a lock icon and a web address that starts with HTTPS, where S stands for secure. So have a wonderful time this season, have a terrific new year, and enjoy every day of this most joyous holiday.
French hens, and a partridge in a pear tree.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Natalie McNeil is an Emmy Award-winning media entrepreneur, author of She Takes on the World and The Conquer Kit, and the creator of SheTakesOnTheWorld.com. Forbes recognized the site as one of the top 10 websites for entrepreneurial women. And she joins me today. Where are you currently, Natalie?
I'm currently in Seattle on my book tour.
Oh, well, congratulations on that. Natalie McNeil, of course, is with me today. Natalie, quite a number of women have been starting their own businesses. That's up 59% between 1997 and 2013. And many of them didn't have a roadmap or MBA degrees or any kind of financial planning experience or management. Are these the women that you're talking to?
Absolutely. We've just seen this growing trend of women leaving the workforce in droves to stay at home and run their own companies. So it is an incredible trend that we're seeing right now. And it's like you said, there's a roadmap that is needed that's missing, and that traditional business training is just not solving right now.
So I guess that is your niche then, is trying to fill that gap, the knowledge gap, and maybe give them workbooks, or I know that you have the Conquer Club as well, so I guess they can share ideas.
Yes, the Conquer Club is a full 12-month business incubator that connects women entrepreneurs with the mentorship team that they need, because really, being successful in any area comes down to having the right support system. And if you don't have the right people raising you up, there's no way you're going to reach your fullest potential.
Yeah, having a mentor is very, very important when you're getting into a field that you're not very familiar with. So I think, again, your service and your website and your blog are filling this niche. What are some of the top mistakes that most women are making when they're starting their own business?
Not having the support is really one of the top ones that we're seeing. And not just not having the support, but not having different perspectives. So the other mistake that I see a lot of women making is finding only one mentor, finding only one person who is giving them advice. And for me, in my own experience running businesses for over 10 years, it has been the diversity in perspectives that I've been able to get from different mentors that I think have allowed me to go further faster. And so in the Conquer Club and with the Conquer Kit and everything that I'm doing, we try to connect people to a range of different experiences and expertise, because I think that is one of the most important things. And then the last mistake I see a lot of women make is not actually hiring help to actually grow and take their business to the next level. Everybody needs at least a virtual assistant, or, you know, you could free up more time by having somebody clean your house or take over more of the housekeeping and at-home responsibilities so that you have time for working on the bigger picture. So just the support system is the biggest thing that's missing. You know, you can't be superwoman. You need to have the help in place.
Well, what I see, it seems to me, you're accomplishing here is that your own site, your own business, is in a sense a reflection of what you're teaching. It's a work in progress. As you learn and change, you share those with others. And actually, from looking at some of the videos and some of your previous interviews, I can see that you basically started from scratch and you're just imparting kind of the information. And you've basically turned your website into something very successful. And this is a model that other women, and I suppose men as well, of course, we shouldn't exclude them. But is it a set model that you're showing them, or is it just the process?
Well, for SheTakesOnTheWorld.com, we try to share a lot of the resources that we are actually using in our business. And we're really transparent about what is working and what's not working for us. And I think it's that transparency that people really appreciate. And people enjoy seeing the behind the scenes and seeing all the little improvements that we're making along the way. We do a lot of tweaking. And one of the only real jobs I ever had was working in quality control for Toyota as a student. And that taught me so much about Kaizen and continual improvement and putting things out there that aren't perfect and recognizing no one is perfect, but that you are always having to make those improvements along the way that will make your product better, that will better serve your customers. And that's the way that I look at it. Everything is a work in progress, and we are just sharing that journey and letting people in the behind the scenes so that they can see what is working for us and then apply it to their own businesses as well. And we never try to be perfect or want to come across as having figured it all out, because I think we all are just works in progress.
As you're listening to this, if you want to hear this interview again or find out more information about Natalie, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Natalie, you have mentioned in your writing that a lot of people have side businesses, whether they're yoga instructors or artists, or they own a small fitness company, or they work for something like that. A lot of this is on the side. What do you tell these women who it's really not a full-time gig, so to speak? How do you counsel them?
I love when people take the risk and do something on the side. I think there's so much power in still having your full-time job, but it's important that you set a date by which you are going to leave. And leading up to that date, what you do between the hours of 5 and 9, so you know, you might be working a 9 to 5, your 5 to 9 plan is key. So every day, what are those 1 or 2 baby steps that you can take to move toward your vision, to move toward actually leaving that full-time job, to dive into your side hustle and make it your full-time gig? So that is the key thing. I get people to set a date by which they're going to leave and have that on their calendar so that they know what they're working toward, and then create that 5 to 9 plan, and recognizing that you may not be able to do as much as someone who's running their business full-time, and that's okay. Big visions and big dreams are achieved one baby step at a time.
You know, Natalie, there are a lot of bloggers out there and they're multiplying by the day. How did you get traffic? How did you differentiate yourself? How did you perceive that differentiation and actually get that message out to draw people to your site?
One of the things people don't realize is that I've been writing She Takes on the World since 2008. So in 2008, it started as just my little personal blog while I was building my media and production business and traveling. And where She Takes on the World is today as a full media company with, you know, staff and a community of tens of thousands of women is really the result of consistency over the last 8 years. So consistently putting out quality content, consistently providing value to the community. And along the way, those people who started in 2008 alongside me, those people who were writing blogs in this niche, a lot of them have dropped off. I don't see them creating content anymore. It is challenging to force yourself to create something of value every single week. It's a huge commitment. It requires a lot of time and effort. And I think that's why we are where we are today, is that consistency. And when we were getting started, the other big thing that helped us grow quickly and start getting the attention of bigger media outlets is sharing our opinion and the opinions that were sometimes very controversial. So talking about our experiences as women starting businesses, what that looked like, some of the harassment we would take at certain events. And it was in sharing those experiences really candidly, even though, you know, they started major discussions and were not always well received. It was sharing our opinions fully that I think started to get us the traction in the early days. Yeah. So never shy away from sharing your opinion, even if you think it might create a little controversy or people might not agree with you.
Actually, controversy is a good thing because it gets people to notice you. If you're going to be like everybody else, then you'll just be invisible. You know, you mentioned marketing and you've been doing this since 2008. I can tell you that in my view, all marketing kind of stinks and it doesn't work, but you have to keep working it and working it. It's a war of attrition. And after a while, it does gain traction and you can become very successful. So thank you for taking the time to join us. If you want to hear more about Natalie, this is Natalie McNeil, my guest today, and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thanks so much for taking your time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Catherine Collins is author of The Nature of Investing. After a long and successful career in equity management at Fidelity Management and Research Company, Catherine reinvented herself, earning a Master of Theological Studies degree at Harvard Divinity School. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You know, Catherine, that's quite a leap from stock trading to philosophy. What made you take that leap?
You know, it's funny. I don't think it's a path that's been taken by too many people. And yet the parallels between my theology studies and my studies of natural systems and my investing career were really much stronger than I even imagined myself. I really reached a point in my career as an investor where I wanted to step back a little bit and reflect on the real purpose of investing in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, I found that going to study philosophy and moral philosophy, really more specifically, was a great place to start.
Well, Your book speaks to the idea that following natural systems is a better way of looking at your investments and, I guess, looking at running companies and the like. Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, one trend that I experienced firsthand as an investor over the last 20, 25 years is that we've taken increasingly a little bit of a factory approach to investing, always looking for more efficiency, more automation, more mechanization in some ways. And this trend started to trouble me after a while, and it eventually led me to the study of natural systems. And the point I've reached in those studies is this examination of biomimicry as a great model. And what biomimicry asks you to do before you make a decision or design a product or a process is to pause for a moment, try to reflect on exactly what function it is that you're trying to perform. You know, what's the point? And to be clear on that, and then to ask yourself, what would nature do? WWND, you know, how would nature perform this same essential function? And to use that as your starting point instead of leaping straight for the factory model.
So this is a new word to everyone. It's biomimicry, and it's obviously mimicking the biology and what's going on in nature. But drill down a little bit and give us some examples of how we would follow a natural system for something.
Sure. So one premise that is embedded in a lot of business and investing endeavors is the premise of growth. And pretty often we take some shortcuts in our thinking about growth and we look at just maximizing growth. But if you look at a natural system like a beehive, for example, bees don't just build the biggest hive they possibly can right at the outset. They build the hive as it's needed, kind of a just-in-time approach. And importantly, they build it only as quickly as there are resources to support the ongoing maintenance and real vitality of that hive.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every investor, I think, has had a similar experience where they invested in an endeavor that looked like a real sprinter out of the gates, if you will. And eventually that sprinter stumbled because they didn't invest enough in maybe people or systems or infrastructure to support that rapid growth.
Or maybe companies that built too far, too much, too fast in anticipation
exactly.
of what they thought was to come, but they kind of outbuilt the capacity for customers or whatever it might be.
Right. It's a very common mistake. And it's not saying growth is bad or even that fast growth is bad, but it's really focusing on how that growth is achieved as opposed to just what is achieved.
Well, you talked about the financial industry and the kind of this cookie cutter mechanized approach that takes place much of the time. We have even now, you know, the vast majority of transactions that take place being in this high frequency trading model where within milliseconds, you know, millions and millions of transactions are done. So what are the biggest challenges facing the financial industry today, in your view?
I think in my mind, there's a real distinction between investing and finance. And it's not a familiar distinction to many people, but to me, investing is really that primary transaction where you're trying to create something in the world, something of use and of value. So there's mutual exchange, there's connection, there's mutual benefit. And that's still at the core of what investing is really all about. What has grown really quickly, though, in recent decades is all the tools and mechanics and products and processes that surround that core. And that's what I call financing. It's the processing and the packaging and the reprocessing and repackaging often that we see around that core activity. And what I'd like to do with this book is just really orient all of us as investors back towards that essential core and to get closer in connection to what's actually happening in the world. It has a lot of parallels actually to the food system, you know, where we centralized a lot of things and automated a lot of things. And now we're finding a lot of people trying to peel away some of those layers of processing and get a little closer to those primary ingredients again.
Well, your book speaks to this biomimicry, and you say the simple question at its core is this WWND, what would nature do? So give us some practical examples of how biomimicry can be used in investing.
Sure. One thing that I did early on is just really looked at my own portfolio with these principles of nature in mind. And I realized that there were a lot of things in my portfolio where they did have that essential connection and kind of reciprocal relationship embedded in them. But sure enough, there were a lot of, you know, funds of funds and securities of securities.
Yeah.
And I tried really hard to step back and look at my own life and what purpose those vehicles were serving when it came to my own investment goals. And if I couldn't come up with a really clear purpose and a reason for them to be there, I took that as an opportunity to trim out some of those layers and to find solutions that were still very active solutions, but maybe a little simpler, a little more elegant in their construction, as opposed to maybe overly engineered, as they were in some cases for me.
You know, it seems like a process that would reduce a lot of the noise that's in the system today that investors have so much trouble dealing with. And I think you make a very good point. You have these products of products or funds of funds, or you have derivatives based on something else, and then you have a new derivative based on the derivatives of that something else. And you've lost touch with what's going on in the core, and it's good to kind of come back to what the core meaning is. I know one big theme in the book as well is what you call feedback loops. And, you know, perhaps you can explain it when you're talking about the beehive again. Where's the feedback loop in a beehive, and how can we as investors utilize that to improve our results?
Sure. Well, feedback loops are a really important element of any natural system, and really, in fact, any system that functions in an effective way. And what you need for feedback loops are three things. One is a clear signal. The second is a receptor for that signal. And then the third is an appropriate response, not just any response, but an appropriate response. So if you think of that in a beehive, for example, bees are just terrific communicators, and we have a lot of great scientific research on this now. When bees communicate about resources for pollen and nectar, for example, they come back and they convey not only the location, but also the quality of the pollen and nectar. And importantly, it doesn't stop there. There's also a series of feedback loops coming from within the hive. So when there's actually enough pollen and nectar that's been gathered, the bees slow down their activity. Again, they don't just maximize for the sake of maximizing. There's a sense of sufficiency. So there are a couple things there to notice. One is that the loops actually feed on themselves and connect in a really wonderful way. And the second is that they're multidimensional. So when I look at that and compare it to investments, for a lot of us, our primary feedback loop is just price. And we've gotten really precise about that. You can get, you know, microsecond pricing data now. But I wonder if having, you know, microseconds of pricing data is as valuable as having similar data on something else, you know, maybe environmental impact or social impact or the how of growth that we talked about before. It seems to me that having a little less information on price and a little more information on other dimensions might help us to have a healthier system of feedback loops.
Yeah, so it's a question of the quality of information. Price does have information, but is it, you know, the end all be all of all the information that you need to get a good response in this feedback loop to make the best decision possible?
Exactly. And to me, this is very familiar. You know, I grew up in an investment organization that focused on fundamental research, and you would never just look at revenues, for example, and not examine the rest of the financial statements. So I think this is something good investors are already very familiar with, and it's just putting it in a little different context.
My guest is Catherine Collins, and the book is The Nature of Investing, and you can kind of see the framework about this. We've got about a minute left, Catherine. You know, there was a part in the book that was very simple. You were talking about your colleagues at Fidelity and how you would all have to, it wasn't going around the water cooler so much, but there was some other place where you'd have to get, the Quotron,
yeah.
Yeah, years ago, nobody had really a computer at their desk. You had one Quotron in the middle of the office somewhere, and everybody would gather around to get their quotes. And that was a form of getting feedback on what was going on in the world. Take us through that real quick.
Absolutely. So this is a perfect example of something that's gotten much more efficient, but maybe less effective. So to get pricing information on stocks, and this isn't that long ago, it's the early 1990s, we still had to walk down the hall to a shared terminal and type in tickers one by one and wait for the information to come back to us. Now I can do that any minute of the day all over the world, just in my pocket on my phone. There's 10 apps that do it immediately. So the volume of information has gotten much more dramatic, and the speed has gotten much more efficient. In theory, that's a great thing. But what we benefited from were a few things. First, we had to actually walk down the hall with intent. You really had to wonder what the price was doing and have a reason to wonder about it. Mm-hmm. So there was an intention in the questioning. But most importantly, it connected us all to each other personally and also to what was happening in the rest of the market. You know, I would be there looking up construction stocks, but my colleague would be looking at oil prices. And then a third person would be looking at retail comps for the month. And you couldn't help but kind of soak up all that exchange. And it was a very organic, kind of natural bottom-up system. It wasn't something that had to be automated or mechanized.
So lots of questions that you want to ask in terms of how to take a more natural approach to investing. The book is The Nature of Investing. Very interesting stuff to read. My guest, Catherine Collins. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Let's talk about the market, the general market, and we're going to bring it down to kind of what
Sure.
you're experiencing. What's the story with home sales that are pending? Are they rising? Are they falling? What's going on?
Well, actually, the last 10 straight months, it's been declining, which is kind of sad.
Well, you mean the amount of contracts?
The amount of pending sales.
Sales, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, you have to have a property and then it has to get under contract. That's when it's considered pending. And then
yeah.
from pending, it goes to closing.
Okay.
So it's the pending.
The number of pending contracts.
Correct.
So that's a sign. It's an early sign of kind of the future, because what's pending is will eventually close. If that's weakening, then you can kind of point to saying that sales are actually going to be weakening as well.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So they slipped 2.6% in October. It's not a terrible number, but it's just kind of the sign. And you said for the last 10 months.
For the last 10 months. It's really, you know, because of the recent rise in mortgage rates that helped and fueled the number of pool of buyers that are out there.
Yeah. 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 Because it's more expensive. I think rates have risen by about 1.5%. Still basically at historic lows.
Absolutely.
We always want to say that because, you know, in the early part of the 2000s, we had 8% mortgage
right.
rates.
Average.
And
yep.
now they're like, oh, just 5 or 4.
Under 5.
Under 5.
So, you know, come on, we're still half.
Yeah. So higher housing prices are justified because the affordability is still there.
That's right.
But if you are a buyer who could afford a house at 3.5%, you can probably, I mean, barely afford it, let's say.
You're right.
You can't afford it at 4.75%.
That's right. If you were at your max at 3.5% and it bumps up that little bit, that's enough. Because everything's ratio, Steve. They look at your debt to income.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And once that you exceed a certain threshold, they won't lend the money.
You know, skipping ahead here, there was an article that you sent to me that talked about millennials not taking on enough debt. Because they're so conservative.
They are.
You know, they're coming out of the 08 crisis
yep.
and they heard all these messages about how debt is bad and gets into trouble. So now the pendulum has swung completely the other way and they're not taking on any credit card debt. And that hurts them if they go try to get a mortgage.
It does. You know, I have daughters that are of that age and I've told them, you know, you don't buy anything unless you can pay for it. You
yeah.
use credit card for convenience, which is great. But I've also realized I've let them down a little bit because one went to get a car and went to get a car loan and they jacked up the interest rate. And I'm
yeah.
like, well, this is wrong.
That's right.
You know, so.
And the fact that they don't have credit or they don't have debt is really a good thing. But that's not the way
the world thinks.
Lenders
right?
look at it, because they think if you're making more money, you should have more assets and then take on a little bit more debt. Whereas if you don't have the debt, they do the reverse math and they say, well, you must not be making or saving and have the assets to support it.
They like to see 3 credit cards being used. They call it a fat file versus a thin file, which
okay,
is none.
I know that. Okay.
So if you're a first-time home buyer, you know, take on a little bit of debt, pay it
yeah.
off. The real
yeah.
key is
yeah.
pay it off each month. Don't be late. Be responsible.
Yeah, but you know, it's actually more than that. So you're thinking about taking on debt. You know, I listened to Steve and Terry, and they said take on more debt. I don't agree with them. I don't want to do it, but I'm going to do it. Because why haven't I done it? Because I'm afraid that if I do put stuff on my credit card, that I'm not going to have the self-discipline
to pay it off.
Right? But the whole key to it is that you must pay it off. And to me, the real sin is that credit cards give you benefits, points for
yeah.
travel or cash back.
Sure.
Where if you use a debit card, you get nothing.
That's right.
And you're hurting your future ability to borrow money for the important items right. like a house and a car.
And you can get a mortgage. It's not like you're not going to be able to get a mortgage. The difference is it's going to be at a higher rate. Yeah. And that's just wrong.
And it's just wrong.
It's so wrong.
Well, and if you have a 30-year mortgage and you live in a house for, say, 10 to 15 years.
We're talking a lot of money.
That's right.
You know, 1% difference over 30 years.
I know. Okay. So another reason that houses, maybe pending home sales, are dropping is that baby boomers just aren't moving.
Right.
They used to be this idea that, okay, we've got this big house. The kids have grown up in our house. Now the kids are gone. So let's downsize and take that extra money and go travel and now live this other life that we plan. But they're sticking.
They're sticking.
And why are they sticking? That's the question.
Ah, the million-dollar question. And the baby boomers' numbers are growing. In 2006, there was 9 million, and by 2026, there's going to be 16 million.
Yeah, well, that's the number of homeowners between age 65 Correct. And homeowners. 74.
Correct.
So in 2006, there were 9 million homeowners. By 2026, there's going to be 16 million. And so there's a lot of inventory kind of being sucked up there
yep.
that if that doesn't turn. Now, of course, when us baby boomers, and I speak of myself, of course, not of you.
Right. I'm actually a baby boomer.
You're 20 years old. I know you are. You're a baby boomer, okay?
Yep.
I mean, at some time, they're going to sell because we'll no
well,
longer be
die.
On this earth.
Right.
Yeah. But we're talking about what happens before then. So, number one, as people age, they tend to move less.
They're moving less.
There's some nostalgia there. You've got your homes where your kids grow up, the pictures on the wall and all that.
Right. So, well, then there's also the reality. The reality why they're not moving is there's not that many smaller homes that they like or where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason. The other reason is the cost. So let's say, for example, you have $800,000 house and you're moving to a $400,000 house and you've been in that $800,000 house 30 years. Your tax base when you go to the newer house.
Well, first, let's back up. You've been in the house for all those years. You have this homestead exemption, which limits the amount of increase.
That's right.
Right? So your house may be worth $800,000, but maybe you're only paying taxes on
$5,000.
Yeah, or $500,000 house or something
right.
like that. Whatever it is, $5,000. Now you go to a $400,000 house, taxes have gone up, the millage rate has gone up, and now you're establishing a new base at this higher level, so it may absorb a good deal of the savings that you thought you were going to get when you downsized.
That's right.
Wow.
And so it doesn't look as attractive right. as initially sounded.
Plus, if you're going to borrow money, then mortgage rates are
a little bit higher.
They're higher as well. So now if you're going to pay cash, that eliminates that issue.
Right.
So there's real reasons there, but this makes for the complexities and the dynamics
right.
of the real estate market.
But even if you're paying more and you have less house to maintain, if you think of it that way, Steve, if you've got a 4,000 square foot house and you've got to put a new roof on that versus a 2,000 square foot house, that's a big savings just in, I guess, maintenance costs.
The maintenance costs are going to be lower too. So
right.
you've got to put that in the calculation
that's
as well.
That's right. Don't forget those.
All right, cool. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. Carmine Gallo is the 2-time Wall Street Journal bestselling author of the book Talk Like TED, and in that he's referring to the great TED Talks that can be viewed on YouTube and other outlets and so on. He's also a columnist for Forbes.com and Entrepreneur.com, and today we're going to delve into his new book, The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. So, Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
So, this whole idea of trying to convince somebody of your point of view, whether it's to sell a product or to get them to do something that you know is in their best interest, having facts on your side just isn't enough. You have to do storytelling. I guess it's part of our collective DNA, you know, the epical image of our ancestors sitting around a fire, electrified by a wonderful storyteller, is something we can all understand. Has storytelling changed after all of these many millennia?
The tools have changed. We use PowerPoint instead of painting pictures on cave walls.
That's true.
But it's exactly right what you said. It's in our DNA. So what was fascinating and fun for me to write Storyteller's Secret is to get into the science and to speak to neuroscientists who have studied this, and anthropologists who say that storytelling goes back 400,000 years. When people were able to sit around a campfire and tell stories, mm-hmm. that is the milestone in human development because it sparked our imagination. Well, I realized that we're doing the same thing today. Things haven't changed. Richard Branson, who I've interviewed a couple of times, gathers his team around a campfire at his home on Necker Island, and they specifically do so for the purpose of sharing stories. And in fact, he said, not too long ago, Richard Branson said that if you want to be a successful entrepreneur, you'd better have a good idea and you'd better be a great storyteller.
Yeah. So I can imagine Richard Branson on one of his islands sitting around a campfire, but I have a feeling that campfire is something digital or different. Is it?
There's actually, he commissioned a local artist to create the most beautiful fire pit you've ever seen. So okay. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I knew it had to be something like that. What does the science say which proves our basic human response to storytelling?
Well, this is the most fascinating part. We now have more evidence in the last 10 years that story is the most effective component of persuasion. We've learned more in the last 10 years than we've ever known. Because we have MRI, we have lab tests, we have data now. So we're learning several things. They're doing research at Princeton University where they are finding that when two people tell each other a story, the brains of both the speaker and the listener are in sync. It's called neural coupling, which means that if I tell you a story, they can see the same regions of our brain having that same blood flow. They call it neural coupling. I call it having a brain sync. You know, I mean, we're just in sync with each other. Paul Zak on the other end of the coast in Orange County, California, or in Los Angeles, is studying oxytocin. And I've had a couple of conversations with Dr. Zak. So what he finds is that when you are watching a gripping or heart-wrenching story, that when they take a blood draw, there's a much higher level of the molecule oxytocin, which is the love molecule, that creates empathy between two people. And they are finding that a higher level of oxytocin is more likely to incite someone or persuade someone to give money to a charity. So in other words, when we hear stories, it's doing something to our brain. It is triggering a rush of chemicals, cortisol, dopamine, and oxytocin. So stories actually do work on our brain. And that's because, getting back to what we just talked about, Steve, we're hardwired for story. Mm-hmm. This is the way we process information.
Well, we live in an age which is increasingly being dominated by robots and automation. And I guess the question is storytelling a purely human endeavor? Can it be replicated automatically or autonomously through robots, or is that going to be the great differentiator?
Well, this is why I'm excited about the topic, because I started writing about storytelling just strictly from a business perspective, because venture capitalists, billionaires like Richard Branson, VCs, great leaders, they were all telling me the same thing. They were all telling me, Carmine, if you speak to entrepreneurs or small business owners or business professionals, please tell them that facts alone are not enough. Mm-hmm. They're not doing storytelling. They have to wrap their data in narrative, in emotion, in story. So this was, for me, a pure play business book. Till I started to realize, and I read a lot of material on this subject, that computers and automation are replacing almost every human task. And it's quite frightening because there are tasks which just a few years ago we didn't think would ever be automated, more creative tasks. So it is frightening and it's displacing jobs, but there is one skill that so far at least, and in the foreseeable future, robots cannot replicate, and that's the human power of emotion through story.
I see.
So to me, now it becomes an even bigger ultimate competitive advantage, not just in business, but in life.
Saying that the emotional aspect of the human condition is something that is maybe the fundamental differentiator between us and robots.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be your ultimate competitive advantage. So you remain relevant in the workplace.
Very good point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long ago, I mean, just real quickly.
Sure.
I spoke to a young 25-year-old man who had some technical experience. He was looking for a new job. He had some technical experience, but not much. And so on paper, he didn't look that good compared to a lot of other candidates. But in his first job interview, he said he had read some of my work and really practiced communicating what that company's vision was and their products and all that. They hired him in 2 days. He doubled his salary.
Yeah.
And they told him specifically, they said, we have plenty of people who know the technical part, but not that many who can communicate it well.
My guest is Carmine Gallo. The book is The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. So we all know one archetypal typical story is the rags to riches storyline. What are some of the other archetypical stories that we're very, very familiar with?
Well, first of all, rags to riches, keep telling them. We are wired. Here's something else in this literature. We are wired to love rags to riches stories because we need to hear them. We need to find meaning in struggle. So if you have struggled, or you have failed and learned something from it, by all means, continue to share those personal stories because they make a connection with people.
Mm-hmm.
But the other structure that I like is by stealing a page from Hollywood. All commercially successful movies have a three-part structure, and you can use this in your very next business pitch or presentation.
What are they?
Part one is the setup. So there has to be the backstory, the status quo. Here is the hero's world as it is. Part two is the conflict. That's where we get the villain. And part three is the resolution. Every movie, almost every commercially successful movie, has to follow the three parts. In a business pitch, Steve, it's very simple. So let's say you are advising someone or a new client or a prospect. Paint a picture of the world as it is for that particular company or client. Act two, there's a problem or a challenge. You know, they're about to hit an iceberg in Titanic. They may not even see the iceberg, but you're going to show them that conflict. Part three is the resolution, and that is how your business, your idea, your service is going to make their world a better place.
Yeah.
Three structures, you could do that in 1 minute. 1 minute story.
You know, the one story that comes to mind when you describe this is basically the story of Cinderella, which is, I understand is told in many cultures. The backstory, you know, the poor young girl and the backstory about the evil sisters. And so there's your villains. And then, of course, you know, the rise to final fame and fortune and so on.
A screenwriter taught me that Cinderella and Rocky, those movies work because there is a very strong dramatic arc.
Yeah.
So they can't just be not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be really down in the dumps.
Yeah.
And then they have to be at a castle at the end. I mean, there has to be a big dramatic arc.
There's a great Kurt Vonnegut video, YouTube. It's on YouTube. He was lecturing, I don't know, must have been 34 more years ago on a blackboard. And he discusses just that, the exact arc of Cinderella. I'm going to send it to you. You're going to love it. What level of language in business or otherwise should you be using? Should you be speaking at a college level, at a high school level, or what's the best level of language to use?
Well, I hope we don't offend anybody on our radio station today. Sixth grade level.
Sixth grade.
Okay, and I do have a lot of proof for this. But let me add this caveat. When, and this is actually an important caveat, when you have a message that needs to be communicated to the widest possible group of people, it helps to speak in sixth grade language. Sixth grade language, meaning a typical sixth grader can probably understand and read it, and that the words are short. The sentence structure is very simple. There isn't a lot of jargon. It's not very confusing, just very simply laid out. And I have a lot of evidence for this. Bill Gates, in his newsletter, every year Bill Gates sends out this beautiful newsletter that talks about philanthropy in the world and some of the challenges that he and Melinda Gates see. Take a look at the last newsletter. I took all of the content from it. I put it into a tool that actually measures text for grade appropriate levels. And it turned out to be about sixth grade. So what Bill Gates has done beautifully is he has learned to take complex information and reduce it to a very simple language. Yeah. We're seeing this a lot. Steve Jobs did this all the time. Elon Musk. I have a whole chapter on Elon Musk. I took an entire presentation of his that, again, meant for the masses, for the masses, not just two engineers, meant for the masses. And it's about sixth grade level. And he would say things like, this is real. Pollution is real. Yeah. Our air is dirty.
Yeah,
this is the answer. This is the solution. It is called the sun. Very simple language.
Right. Now, I just saw on YouTube him rolling out the battery for the home. And that's exactly the terminology he used. We have this big fireball in the sky that gives us unlimited energy. Right? We can all see that image.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Now, you interviewed, I think, 50 storytellers, and there was quite a range. And you mentioned Richard Branson, but you've also interviewed or you write about Howard Schwartz from Starbucks, but even Joel Osteen, the incredibly successful televangelist. What's different? What's the same about those very three vastly different characters and other characters that you've written about? And what's really the same?
Well, the first third of the book, and this is, again, I did not intend for this to happen, but the first third of the book talks about how you need to reframe the message or the story you tell yourself. You will never inspire others unless you're inspired yourself, unless you actually believe and have confidence that your story is worth being heard and shared. So Joel Osteen, this is not a religious book in any way, but Joel Osteen, obviously, is a very successful motivational speaker. For 17 years, he did not believe that he belonged on stage. And today, he sells out Yankee Stadium. He sells out stadiums around the world. Can you imagine how nervous most people would be speaking to 50,000 people? And yet, 17 years ago, or for 17 years, he never saw himself doing that. And the first time he preached, Joel Osteen told me that he was absolutely paralyzed with fear. I mean, he was shaking at the lectern.
I know a lot of people can relate to that for sure.
Yeah.
Now, his father was a pastor.
It all starts with changing your internal thought structure, speaking differently to yourself.
Yeah.
It all starts in your head.
Well, is it the Stuart Smiley thing, like from the old SNL, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me? Or is it something a little bit more sophisticated than that?
It's not that much more sophisticated. You know, visualization. I mean, we know from great athletes, great winners, that they visualize themselves.
Yeah, they visualize, yeah.
Right? So you have to visualize. If you have a fear of public speaking, you absolutely have to go through the motions and visualize yourself as a strong speaker. Shonda Rhimes, the Grey's Anatomy producer, was paralyzed with fear of public speaking. And she wrote a book called The Year of Yes. You may have heard of it. The Year of Saying Yes, where she actually accepted opportunities that she never would have accepted before. Yeah. She had to say yes to everything. And she realized that she became more confident by doing those things which she originally feared. Now she embraces
it. I hadn't heard that, but I actually have gone through my own personal experience with a period of saying yes to things I had formerly said no to. So that's quite interesting for me. We have interviewed Barbara Corcoran, which is one of the people in the book, but you mentioned an individual by the name of Bryan Stevenson. Not a household name by any imagination. He's a TED speaker. Tell us quickly about him.
Bryan Stevenson is a human rights attorney. He earned the longest standing ovation of any TED speaker in TED's 30-year history. So look him up, Bryan Stevenson. He is a very successful attorney who wins cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. So he knows how to persuade. If you watch a 15-minute presentation by Stevenson, there's three personal stories. So what he does is he tells a personal story, then he delivers the data that he intends to communicate to his audience? Personal story, data, personal story, data. So there's three stories. The data reinforce the story, but the data doesn't come first. Whereas in most business presentations, what do we all do? It's all just a data dump,
yeah.
But there's no emotion. Mm-hmm. Brian Stevenson knows, and he has told me that narrative is hugely important in persuasion.
Personal story, data, personal story. People relate to who you are and the struggles you've dealt with in your life. And that's the way to kind of to start setting up the image that you're trying to portray.
Or in business or business pitch, it could be a case study. Mm-hmm. I know you're an investment advisor. It can be, obviously, you have a million case studies of people who did something or who did not take a plan of action,
yeah,
and may have suffered because of that. Mm-hmm. So those are equally as powerful as personal stories.
Very interesting. The book is The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. My guest is Carmine Gallo, the author. And to find out more about Carmine and to hear this interview again and get the transcripts for this interview as well, join us at stevepomerantz.com. Carmine, was wonderful. Thank you so much. This week on the On the Money Minute, insurance. When is enough enough? Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Guess what? You might be overinsured. If you no longer need a big death benefit because your kids have left home, your spouse has died, or the mortgage is paid up, dump that term policy or replace it with a smaller one. And for gosh sakes, rid yourself of that terrible whole life insurance policy. It's called whole life because that's where your money goes, in a hole. You may want to recalculate your insurance needs using any of the online calculators. There are some at Fidelity.com, also over at SmartMoney.com. What are some of the other ways to save? Pay premiums annually instead of quarterly or monthly. But never, ever cancel a policy before getting a new one. Medical tests required by new insurers before issuing a new policy could reveal a health problem that could send your premium soaring. I'm Steve Pomerantz. To hear more on the Money Minutes, plus Steve's weekly radio show, go to stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.